You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
Welcome to the Screamcast, episode 108. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is BJ Colangelo.
I'm back again!
Right.
I'm singing only because I know it makes Brad uncomfortable and mad.
And with us, of course, is Brad Henderson.
Whatever.
Sorry about the no-show last week. Last week was a shit. Last week was just a shit. A ball of shit of a week.
Agreed.
So we just took a break.
Just like rolled up like the just, ball that Icarus tried to push like that. That kind of shit.
Yeah. Totally. Just a rough, peanut-filled shit.
Damn, dude.
It was last week.
You need more fiber in your diet.
So anyway, thank you guys for being patient. We're going to be recording another episode. We're going to be doing a Vinegar Syndrome episode. It'll be posted early next week, hopefully Monday. I should be able to edit over the weekend. So look forward to that. But today we're going to be talking some James Wan and some Conjuring 2 because we all saw it. We all saw the same theatrical film the same week.
Which so, has, I don't think, happened yet.
I don't think so. So we'll be talking about that. But first, let's find out what's on our doorstep.
Okay.
Holy cow. I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
I will go first because it's incredibly boring. So I think the last time I talked, I had just moved. Well, here's a fun fact. When you have moved and you own the 13 totes of movies like I do, you can't exactly put those up until you have a couch placed because that determines where your bookshelves go.
Yes.
So I've acquired a shitload of movies. I have watched nothing. I have watched Netflix. So the only movies that I've watched were things that I found on Netflix. So I checked out Ava's Possessions, which is one that I had seen before, but it was nice to revisit. I think that it's a fun little movie on Netflix. I think that it suffers from having way too many storylines going on at the same time, but I think that the concept is really cool. I think the lighting is very interesting and not what is really being done by a lot of indie people. It's got kind of that, you know, the harsh pink and blue tones that you don't really see done often, unless you're Nicholas Winding Refn, then you see it all over the time or all over the place. But you know, it's a fun movie, but not something that I'm gonna be like, if you want to watch a really good possession movie, watch Ava's Possessions, because I don't think that it's that great. It's billed as like a horror comedy, but I don't think that it's particularly that funny, which is a problem. But
because its premise is funny,
that's right? The premise is I think that it suffers from the screenwriter having a really, really good idea, but not having a story to go with it. It's a great premise. It's a terrible story. So, I mean, it's good for me to watch because I think that it gets my brain working of, well, how would I have done it? One of those movies that makes for good brainstorming if you're a screenwriter, but if you're looking for like a comedy or, you know, what the poster art on Netflix is trying to sell you, you're not going to get that. But I'm not upset that I watched it again. So that was Ava's Possessions. And then the second one that I watched wasn't technically horror. I kind of got bamboozled by Netflix here. Their new layout and their new poster selection and their categorizing of things has been a little fucky lately. So every once in a while I'll grab something and be like, oh, this is going to be a fun little thriller. And then it ends up being like borderline a Lifetime movie, which is what happened with A Girl Like Her, which the cover of it is, you know, two faces of these young girls. One of them has a very sinister look on her face and the other one looks like she's like dead. So I saw that and immediately was like, oh, this is going to be like a, you know, a younger version of The Roommate or something to that effect. Nope. It was about how mean girls are and cyberbullying and the whole like suicide crisis that's going on with like the youth of today because of how goddamn mean and ruthless they are. And now it's all being documented because of social media. So it's set up like a documentary, but it's all fiction, but it's very, very convincing. Almost to a level of uncomfortability where we follow this young girl who's being just relentlessly and mercifully teased. Mercilessly, that's the word. I'm sorry, radiation, what's up? mercilessly teased to the point where, like, this girl is just, she's so fucking mean to her. And when you watch it, you're like, that's not how kids today act. It is how kids today act. And that's what makes it even more horrifying because it seems like it's on a cartoonish level of cruelty, but that's exactly how kids are acting. Like, they're just bombarding her with text messages that are like, you're fat, kill yourself, just horrible shit. And, you know, her friend convinces her, like, you should wear one of these hidden cameras and document it so we can, you know, show the principal that this shit isn't cool. Long story short, the real movie kind of kicks off when this girl who's being teased commits suicide and ends up in a coma. So then she is not able to express how mean this girl is. There's all these rumors that this girl's been picking on her who, you know, obviously she's denying it. So then you kind of change the scope and focus on her and you realize, you know, she's from kind of a broken home and like all of the things that go into creating bullies. Like, why are you a bully? And then it forces her, obviously, because it turns into a Lifetime movie real quick, where it forces her to like see the monster that she's really become or whatever. If you have preteen girls, highly recommend watching it with them because it is a very unflinching look at how mean girls really are. I especially recommend it for fathers who have never been a teenage girl. It is a little ham-fisted and a little after-school special-y at times where you're like, this, okay, that's a bit much. But, I mean, I unfortunately watched it and the whole time was like, yeah, that is exactly how girls talk to each other. And it's really mean and really unforgiving and really awful. But, I know. I think good life lessons can be learned from it. But that was pretty much it. I can't wait to have, you know, a couch and to be able to put away my films because we've bought probably $250 worth of movies since we've moved here. So I've got a lot to watch. I rewatched Goosebumps, but I talked about that a while ago. It was on Netflix. It makes me happy. And I'm getting better at being able to watch Lawn Gnomes and not shit my pants. So
progress.
Baby steps. Yeah, baby steps. Progress. That's my doorstep. I'm real boring. I've been gone for 3 weeks and I have nothing to show for it. I binge watched a lot of Netflix. I've been binge watching the shit out of this new podcast called Sword and Scale. If you like true crime and don't like to sleep because it's just makes you really hate life, I highly recommend Sword and Scale. It'll fuck you up for days. But that's it. That's my doorstep.
Awesome. Brad, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How's everybody doing?
We lost you for a sec, but you are back.
Yeah, I'm back.
I'm remembering how to speak English because I haven't done it in so long.
Oh.
Brad, cool. Do you have like 107 movies you need to talk about? Should I go first or?
No. I mean, I could just talk real quick.
Impossible. I don't believe you.
Yeah, I can do it.
I'm timing you now. No, I'm just kidding. What's on your doorstep, Brad?
I watched the sequel. It took me a while. to watch the sequel, but I watched Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
How'd you like it?
I liked it. It was all right. It was just about as good as the first one. I liked the apes in it. That's all I got.
Maybe I should go for a little bit so we can find the real Brad.
No, that's it. That's it. That's all you watch.
That's
Dude,
all you
I'm
have.
Like, I'm moving.
Are you
like,
sick?
I'm packing
oh,
up.
Oh, you're moving. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Where are you moving? Do you have like a big-ass yard and a big-ass house?
He took some Screamcast money. He bought himself a palace.
Yeah.
Yeah, he took that like $4 in sponsorship. Got himself real pretty.
I have some limited edition Blu-rays coming out, too. They're going to be pressed for real. And you can purchase them on the Screamcast.com.
I almost, iced tea almost came out of my nose just now.
Iced almost. Tea, like the drink or iced tea, the person? Because I would be way more interested if iced tea, the person, came out of your nose.
That would be problematic, I think.
I know. You'd have some serious sinus issues. You'd need to see a doctor.
Yeah, I think so. All right, so I'm taken aback that Brad only has one thing to plug. So, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Did you like it? I liked it better than the first one.
It doesn't have that dynamic with Caesar and, of course, James Franco's character, which I thought was really, really great. Seeing kind of the Koba and Caesar animosity build, you kind of knew the direction the film was going, like right off the bat. And I thought that was kind of boring. Is everybody still there?
Noah, I was just riveted by James Franco.
Oh, Noah's joining us.
Oh, yeah. Looking for that candy time.
All right, little story about my son. Today he discovered he has two jelly beans while he was in the bath.
Did your kid discover his balls?
He discovered his balls today.
I was just telling Brad that I came to the realization while you were gone that I don't actually know how old your children are. I just see pictures of them and kind of throw arbitrary numbers at
them. 3, 8, and 11.
3, 8, and 11, okay.
Yeah, 8-year-old's turning 9. But the 3-year-old today, just all of a sudden he's splashing around and he says, jelly beans. I got jelly beans. And what are you doing? He goes, what? He goes, there's something here. And then he stands up and points to his little nutsack. And I go, oh, those are your balls.
Did I ever tell you about the time my godson realized what a boner was? He just like came out of the room and he had morning wood. And he just goes, I have a boner. We're like, oh, fuck.
Should I still do that every fucking morning?
Kids are great. All right. Anyway, so I'm sorry, Brad. You're really interrupted by my goddamn 3-year-old.
No, but, it's okay.
Jelly beans.
Mm-hmm. It's a decent sci-fi 8 movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was a solid sequel. I just kind of like, you know, the whole thing, what's building up between Caesar and Koba. So it's like, it's okay. It's okay. Movie.
All right. Very cool. All right. So I watched a couple things. I watched this new film. I think it's out in select theaters right now, but it's available for video on demand. Directed by Alex Brewer and Benjamin Brewer, starring Elijah Wood and Nick Cage. It's The Trust. Which is about two cops who are kind of, you know, bored with their jobs, and Nicolas Cage's character gets the idea to basically rob a heroin dealer, because he discovered that they have some sort of safe or something in this building, and he wants to basically rob it. And he talks Elijah Wood into doing this with him, and I liked it a lot. This is Unhinged Cage.
Ooh.
Which is great.
That's the best Cage.
He's having fun. You know what I mean? He's not trying to be dour or anything. He's having fun with this role. And that's always the best. He's always the best when he's like that. So this is a good Nick Cage film, not a paycheck Nick Cage film. And, I mean, Elijah Wood is fantastic as always. He needs to just shave. He needs to try to let a beard grow, though. That's the one criticism that, my wife had for him. And I agreed.
I kind of like the scruffy look.
I don't know. He just consistently looks 16.
But that's why I like the scruffy look, because it makes me feel less creepy.
But it was really good. I had a lot of fun with it. It's a smaller cast, and but it's funny. Like, it's funny in all the right places, but it's also thrilling where it needs to be. So I would recommend you check it out. I don't want to give anything away, but I love how the cops are interacting. Like, they're on a crime scene, and it's all just work for them. You know what I mean? And they capture that really well. Like, you know how monotonous things are in my office that I work in. Like, you know, the try to just make a few copies, or the copier breaks and you got to fix it or whatever. Like, they're treating a crime scene like that. So that is pretty fantastic. So I would check it out. Have you guys seen this at all yet?
I only talked about it on the South by episode.
Oh, that's right. You saw this at South by Southwest.
Yeah. Wow. You're getting a little heated there.
Wow, yeah. Man, chill out.
It's a nice color on you.
Stand down.
It was all right. I mean, it's definitely, it has a lot of potential for the first, like, 30, 45 minutes. And then it gets into serious time when they're actually doing the heist, and it just gets kind of brutally boring, I thought. And then it picks up, and it's like, wait, this isn't no longer a comedy. It's a drama. Oh, yay. And it just gets super serious, and it kind of ruins the whole buddy cop thing that it had going really well too.
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah. It was definitely front loaded for sure. As far as the dynamic.
I was cracking up. I was like, man, Nick Cage and Elijah Wood need to make buddy comedies. This needs to be a franchise. But then it brutally stops, and it's like, okay, wait, this is no longer a comedy. Forget everything that just happened, because now it's like a serious heist movie. And it just is like, I don't know. It played with my emotions.
Hmm.
I really loved the first half, and then I kind of wanted to turn it off or walk out during the second half, because I just don't like – I'm not a fan of when movies kind of just – totally negate what they were trying to do and what they were building up, and they're just like, hey, you know what, different movie now. And I just can't grasp that. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it worked a little better for me. I kind of just went with it. But you're right. I mean, is the dynamic between those two in the beginning of the film is a lot more enjoyable than
Like, they both can do drama at times. I mean, obviously, Elijah Wood can do better drama than Nicolas Cage, because he just does Cage Rage. But he never went to that. Nicolas Cage was very contained the whole film, which I liked. But, you know, it just became flat characters after that. You know,
Yeah,
I don't know. It was really upsetting, because it felt like it was truly something special. Like, if you told me, hey, you want to watch a buddy cop movie where Nicolas Cage and Elijah Wood are friends? And it's like, no, but yes, very, very much so. Let's watch that. And it's like working perfectly. And you're like, what the fuck is happening? This is the Twilight Zone. And like, it had such charm, and the characters were so charismatic and so silly and goofy, and they work so well together, and then it got super fucking serious. It gets super serious, Sean.
I know.
Super.
It does. Yeah.
Like, the ending, you're like, why? What is this? What's going on? You were like touching evidence and like fucking up and goofing off like at the crime scene, and now we just have this ending where I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, I don't want to get into spoiler territory, but I feel like,
right? No, I know.
The way that they are, I feel like, you know, I mean, they're technically not really good guys. So I feel like, you know,
they're not, but the thing is that it's handled in such a way that you have two people that are inexperienced for what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
and they're in over their heads, but they completely take away, like 100% take away the comedy aspect of the movie.
Yeah.
So it would be different. And we were just talking about this before the show, like how films are one thing and then completely change right in the middle. And it to me, that's confusing. Like it doesn't flow. It's jarring to me that it's like, I forget what movie I'm watching now. Like, am I not laughing anymore? Am I supposed to laugh at this?
Right. Fun fact, I may have dozed off right when the turn happened and woke up and just finished watching the movie.
But the thing is, it slaps you right in the face when it turns.
I think, you know what? I think I missed the part where it got super serious because I woke up. I think I dozed for like 5 minutes. I must have. This is my problem. Oh my God. This is my problem lately. Jesus. I was like,
is this a reoccurring pattern for
when
you?
When I sit down and to watch a movie, I turn into a friggin' narcoleptic when I sit on my couch. So I think that's what happened. I think I missed when it turned, like did the hard turn, and I just kind of was like, oh, I'm just gonna see how this plays out. It definitely was more serious. Yeah, there's a good 10 minutes there that I must have missed.
Dang, now it's 10.
Damn.
I mean, it's an okay movie. You're not going to be bored. It's just I was really – like they really had something with the buddy cop aspect.
Yeah, the first half is fantastic. So the good thing is I rented it for about $6.99. For me, it's a one-timer. You know, watch it once and enjoy it for what it is and then move on. I definitely wouldn't buy it. But you're right. Yeah, it is, you know, but for what it was, I dug it, but it did not get put into the to buy list. It got into put into the one timer list. So this will probably end up on Netflix. If you ever seen it on Netflix, I think it's a definite, you know, Netflix watch. For sure. This next one I'm way more enthusiastic about, and it's starring Owen Wilson.
Oh boy.
No Escape. From last year with Pierce Brosnan, Owen Wilson, and some other people.
It's already that cast makes, like, I know that you said that, and I do want to see it because of what you said.
Mm-hmm.
And because you sing its praise, I'll watch it. But, dude, if you just say Owen Wilson, I automatically say no.
This is why I. This
why
is
do you
why...
like Owen Wilson?
Well, and then when you say Pierce Brosnan, I'm like, all right. Definitely not.
I figured this would just be like some, you know, direct-to-DVD type stupid Lionsgate action flick, right? Something like that. It's kind of what it looks like. But
it looked like a Vacation Gone Wrong movie.
Yeah, and it kind of is. It's, you know,
yeah,
this guy gets transferred with his family to freaking Cambodia or something like that. To work for the water district or the water works there. He's like the new manager of that plant. So he has to transport his whole family over to Cambodia. He just arrives. I don't know. It's like, I feel like, I'm like, did you not think this through? Did you not go to check it out? Maybe get a house first. It's like he got the job and just takes his whole family to Cambodia and doesn't really have a plan. Like they're going to stay at a hotel until they figure it out, which to me was like, you know, I wouldn't do that personally with my family. But anyway, so the whole gist of the film is basically right when he arrives, a coup occurs and they overthrow like the prime minister. And basically, they're trying to, this coup or whatever, these rebels or whatever the hell they are trying to round up every single white person they find and just kill them. Because, apparently he's responsible for them, a lot of locals losing their jobs at the water plant. That's the basic gist of it. So it definitely sounds like direct to DVD action flick.
It sounds like the movie I avoided in the 90s.
Yeah. But the execution, it's so brutal and so tense that it surprisingly works. I mean, it works on so many levels, I think, especially because I'm a parent. Like there's so many little moments with the kids, like I would think, like, what if I was in this situation with my kids? What would I do? And the kids are very believable. I mean, there's one scene where the youngest daughter, like, he's trying to carry her away from danger, and she drops her little teddy bear, and she's more concerned about losing her teddy bear than, you know, a bunch of people trying to kill them, kill the family. Like little things like that. Like I guarantee you my kid would probably do that. But it's a thrilling film. Like it's super intense. It never really lets up. Pierce Brosnan is fantastic in it. There's this grizzled, you know, European that they kind of cross paths with. He's badass. And, it's definitely worth checking out. I was super surprised by this film. And Owen Wilson kind of, because for me, I haven't really dug any of his real serious work. I don't think he's more of, I've liked him in his comedy.
Has he ever done a serious movie?
Oh, he did, oh shit, what is that?
Exactly.
Enemy at the Gate. No, is it Enemy at the Gate? That's another one.
Behind Enemy Lines.
Both those movies came out around the same time, I think.
Fucking terrible.
And both of those movies disappointed me. Yeah, Behind Enemy Lines is horrible.
Enemy at the Gates is okay.
It's okay.
See, but Behind Enemy Lines has that sick sequence where he's setting off all the foot traps.
God.
I'm kidding. The movie's awful.
He's great in this because he kind of has that, he's like the kind of this goofy dad kind of thing. The only criticism I think I'd have with this would be like there's certain scenarios that like if he's just a normal day every man, like these people would all be dead. Like with the amount of shit that's going on, like they got some luck going on. But all that aside, it moves, it's really thrilling.
He was in The Minus Man. That's a great movie that
I've never
did.
Seen that.
Yeah. So he did that like in the 90s or something. He had a movie called The Minus Man where he played like a serial killer.
Oh, really?
Huh. Yeah, I remember that. That was fun.
Check that out. So I would definitely give this a watch. No Escape. Unfortunately, it's not, not a remake of the Ray Liotta movie.
Yeah.
That movie needs to come out on Blu-ray. The sci-fi No Escape. That movie's fantastic.
Who directed this No Escape?
John Eric Dowdle.
Oh, okay. I know that guy.
What else is he?
Yeah, the Poughkeepsie Tapes. Devil.
As Above, So Below?
As Above, So Below. Quarantine. The remake of REC. The remake of REC isn't that bad.
It's not that bad.
It's just a straight up rip of, like, it's almost shot for shot.
Yeah.
Here's my question about Quarantine. In Rec, did the cameraman use his camera to bash a zombie's face?
No.
See, once that happened, since I used to be a cameraman, I used to deal with cameras and stuff, I was like, I tuned out. I was like, that camera's busted. There's no way that camera's usable. And so I turned the movie off. I said, fuck Quarantine. I'm sticking with Rec. But Devil's pretty damn good.
You think Devil's good?
I like Devil a lot.
God, I fucking hated that piece of shit.
Anyway, for me,
I love the Poughkeepsie Tapes. That's obviously his best work.
Well, and as above, so below was
pretty cool.
Yeah,
yeah.
I think he has a pretty good. I think John Eric Dowdle has a good cluster of films here. I think he's on track. You know. So, but No Escape
was
intense.
All right, Sean, I'll watch No Escape.
Dude, you'd like it. I have a feeling you'd like it.
Don't say that. I'm a total fucking dick, dude.
I think you'd like it, man.
I'm a total dick.
It pulls no punches. All right. And then finally, I watched Finding Dory. No, we're not going to talk about that.
I want to know what you think of it. Dude, fuck off. I really do.
Really?
Because I haven't seen it yet. And I love, like...
I took the kids. I had a lot of fun with it. There's a 7-tentacled octopus that steals the movie named Hank. He's fantastic.
Who voices him? Do you know?
Oh, gosh. It's somebody that I should know. Hold on. Cast. Ed O'Neill?
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, Ed O'Neill. He's great. Yep.
Oh, that's amazing.
But it's fun. It's fun. You know, Finding Nemo is fantastic. And, this isn't as clever as Finding Nemo, but, it's fun.
Is it as heart-wrenching?
Oh gosh. There's a couple scenes where I freaking teared up like a little,
No. Will it make me cry more than Inside Out? Because Inside Out wrecked me.
Probably not as much as Inside Out.
Okay, good.
But there
then I can
is a
see
moment.
It in public. I can
there
see it in public. And I'll be fine.
Noah, what are you doing?
Oh, he heard you talking about Finding Dory. That's what happened.
You need to be in bed. Noah, what did you think about Finding Dory?
Not good.
That's not true.
Yeah, everyone's Noah, that's what I'm talking critic. About. That's what I'm talking about.
You better not edit any of that out, because that's incredible.
Okay, you need to sit there quietly and let me talk, okay?
I tell you, oh, I was, eventually I'll see Finding Dory, I guess, when it hits Blu-ray, maybe. Because Willow's not interested at all. And I was like, hey, do you want to go? And she's like, nah. And I was like, yeah. I was like, this movie's 15 years too late, it seems. They spent so much fucking time making fucking cars that talk and fucking planes running around. This is something, and honestly, I don't even remember even finding Nemo that great.
You shut up right now.
I loved it. Oh my god, I loved Finding Nemo.
Yeah, I don't remember liking it all that much. I mean, I think their best work is Up and probably Monsters, Inc.
But did you see Inside Out yet?
Yeah, I thought Inside Out was pretty good.
But Brad has no soul, so.
It's not that I have any soul, it's just that immediately when Pixar comes out, everyone thinks it's the greatest fucking cartoon ever. And that's definitely not the case.
Yeah, some of them aren't that great. Like Cars, they're all terrible.
Yeah, they've made some really shitty
Cars
fucking...
2 is
Oh, and
awful.
That has Owen Wilson in it, too.
Yeah. The Owen Wilson connection.
Yep, he ruined it.
All right.
Ruined Cars.
That's, I think that's it. Oh, we'll talk about it. I tried watching Annabelle, but we'll talk.
Why would you do that?
Well, because I'm giving everything, trying to give everything a fair shake. But,
well, that was your first mistake.
They cast the two worst people for the leads, ever. The most bland, uninteresting people they cast to be our leads, whereas in The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2, what James Wan does is he really gets you, invested with the characters. Annabelle is just
he didn't direct that.
He didn't direct, he produced it. and I know they just were hey, Warner Brothers is just hey, James Wan, we want to make a spinoff with that doll. Can you sign right here? We'll give you some money. And James Wan said, fuck yeah. And then,
they were hey, who can direct this? Can James do it? No. All right. I have an idea. My favorite movie is Mortal Kombat 2. Let's get the director of that.
Oh my god. Was he the director of
directed one movie in his entire life.
Oh my god.
And it's Mortal Kombat 2.
Nope. He directed one other movie.
Everything makes so much sense
what
now.
What is that?
The Butterfly Effect 2.
Oh, he did that too? Oh, I didn't know. He's a great cinematographer. He's a great DP. He definitely has an eye. He definitely amplifies. John Leonetti is a decent DP. He really is.
Yeah.
But dude, what the fuck was Mortal Kombat 2 about? That movie is so off its rocker. And then I hear about Annabelle and I'm like, all right, that's cool. I could watch more of that. And it's John Leonetti, and I'm like, why?
Yeah, there's one.
No one has seen Mortal Kombat 2 at Warner Brothers or whatever. And they're like,
it's a Warner Brothers movie, isn't it?
What New Line did? New Line, Mortal Kombat.
Okay,
but it's just how does nobody in that room making that decision at least pull a Sean and pull up IMDb and just sitting at the boardroom, guys, before we sign this contract, can we watch Mortal Kombat 2 real quick? How did nobody say anything? Is that the only option?
I have no idea how Hollywood operates.
At least with, the Nun spinoff, they got that, the guy that just made that horror film. Because they're doing the spinoff for The Conjuring 2, the Nun, they got, shit.
Did they officially get the director for that?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they announced it. He did a decent horror film recently. Oh, God. All right, never mind.
I'm going to insert some Jeopardy music.
Yeah, I have no idea.
But what there is in Annabelle, there's one for me. There's one decent sequence near the beginning of the film. It's when the wife wakes up, or the neighbors across the way, they can see into their bedroom or whatever, and some shit goes down, and the husband goes away, and then the wife kind of wakes up, and then some splatter happens against the wall. Like that was pretty effective, and then it was just all downhill from there.
It's honestly, Lights Out. He's the guy that did Lights Out movie.
I saw the trailer for Lights Out. It looks awful.
So I thought it was something that already came out. But, I mean, the short film that guy did that's based off of.
That's cool.
The short film is very effective. So I'm pretty excited to see what he could do with the feature with it. Because the fucking trailer is terrifying.
For Lights Out?
Yeah.
Oh, the trailer's bullshit. Yeah.
What? Mm-mm.
I hated the trailer.
Well, the trailer hates you. That looks fucking terrifying.
The beginning of the trailer, I was hooked, and then it kind of got a little, I was just like, okay, I don't know.
No, the movie looks batshit fucking insane. Like, you can't escape. No escape with Owen Wilson.
I'm going to give the movie a shot. I just, the trailer didn't.
I don't know, dude. I think that trailer's fucking
scary. The short film, though, scared the crap out of me.
Yeah, I'm probably going to cry in the theater. Let's be real. I'm fully aware of it, and that's
all right. I've launched the James Wan conversation a little bit here, so let's jump into talking about The Conjuring 2 and the trajectory. I can't even pronounce the word trajectory of James Wan's career.
Trajectory.
But first, we're gonna jump into news with Josh Obishaw. And Josh Obishaw joins us for the news. What's up, Josh?
What's up, Sean? I hope they don't, you know, hold it against us too much considering we were gone for an extra week, but don't worry. We're alive. We're okay. Don't send the ransom. Yeah.
Summertime gets crazy in my life. So probably more so than Brad or anyone else. So bear with us. There may be a few more, you know, lapses in the show here and there, but we'll always communicate to you guys via the social medias, so make sure you're following us on there, on Twitter and Facebook.
Right, and we'll be sure to let you guys know all of the stuff that's coming, so.
Yes. Thescreamcast.com, there's the subscribe little area. We got the Twitter, the Facebook, all that stuff, and find us there. All right, man, what do you got for us today?
Well, we've got to let people know about our sponsor's Vinegar Syndrome's July package. Because we mentioned some weeks ago, we mentioned that they were going to be putting out the Candy Tangerine Man and Lady Coco as a sort of a double feature Blu-ray DVD combo pack. Originally, that was going to be for June, but they decided to take June off. And now this is going to be part of the July package, which means that we'll probably be getting a monthly package for Christmas, which is nice. But for July, we've got The Candy Tangerine Man and Lady Coco, two blaxploitation movies directed by Matt Simber. Now, the bonus features for this, it's going to be a region-free Blu-ray and DVD combo pack. All the extras are going to be on both formats. Both films are scanned and restored in 2K from 35mm archival prints. A director's video introduction for The Candy Tangerine Man. A commentary track for Lady Coco with director Matt Simber and director's assistant / actor John Goff. A reversible cover for Lady Coco and English subtitles. Next up in the package is another Rudy Ray Moore flick. This one's called Petey Wheatstraw. And once again, it's going to be region free. All the extras are going to be on both formats. Scanned and restored in 2K from 35mm original camera negatives. And a making of documentary called I Dolomite Part 3. Plus, we got a commentary track with Rudy Ray Moore's biographer Mark Jason Murray, co-star Jimmy Lynch, and director Cliff Rockmore. Shooting locations revisited. It's a featurette with Rudy Ray Moore. We've got a soundtrack, a promotional still gallery. We got trailers for Disco Godfather, The Human Tornado, and Dolomite. Plus, you also get a reversible cover art and English subtitles for this for that one. And from here on out in the July package, it gets a little sexy. Next up, we've got, first off, Corporate Assets, starring Tish Ambrose, Amber Lynn, Sherry St. Clair, Jamie Giles, or is it Gillis? I can't remember, but Harry Reams is also, sure. Yeah, Harry Reams is also in it too. It's going to be a region-free DVD only. It's going to be scanned and restored in 2K from the 35mm camera negatives, and video interview with lead actor Eric Edwards, and original theatrical trailer. Now here's where it gets really sexy. Next up is a movie called Both Ways. Filled with tense plots, twists from beginning to end, Jerry Douglas's Both Ways is a tightly written and expertly acted hardcore drama delving in one of the most taboo topics in sex, male bisexuality. Co-starring Dean Tate.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah. Co-starring Dean Tate and Darby Lloyd Raines, Vinegar Syndrome presents this forgotten landmark in X-rated cinema, newly restored and totally uncut for the very first time anywhere in the world. This is going to be a region-free DVD only, scanned and restored in 2K, a commentary track from director Jerry Douglas, and an original theatrical trailer. And finally, in the July package is a double feature DVD only of two all-male films. One's called Take One, and the other one is called Moving. Once again, region-free, scanned in 2K, director introductions and commentaries for both films, three deleted scenes from Take One, Wakefield Pool in SF. Let's see, more on Moving, which is a short documentary chronicling the production history of Moving. A couple of bonus short films. One's called Roger, and the other one's called Freedom Day Parade, and there's also a trailer for Moving. Now, all these movies are going to be released individually and together as the package on July 26th. So there's Vinegar Syndrome's July package, Sean.
Wow.
I know, right?
I'm excited for the Blaxploitation, for sure.
Okay.
We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Okay. I won't butt.
When I get them.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot there. But we got a couple of updates from Screen Factory to tell you guys about. We've got the final list of extras for Bad Moon. We've got not only the theatrical cut in high definition, but we've also got a new director's version, supervised and approved by Eric Red. We've also got a new making of featurette called Nature of the Beast, featuring interviews with writer-director Eric Red, actors Michael Paré and Mason Gamble, special effects makeup artist Steve Johnson, and stunt coordinator Ken Kurzinger. Plus, we got a new audio commentary with writer-director Eric Red, commentary with Eric Red and Michael Paré, an unrated opening scene from the director's first cut, which is sourced from VHS, I might add, so just a heads up. Three storyboard sequences and an original theatrical trailer. Now, once again, this one is coming out on July 19th. And the other Screen Factory update I want to tell you about is the remake of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And this is going to be a long list, so here we go. We've got a 2K scan of The Inner Positive, Star-Crossed in the Invasion, which is an interview with actress Brooke Adams, Leading the Invasion, which is an interview with actor Art Hindle, Recreating the Invasion, an interview with writer W.D. Richter, Scoring the Invasion, an interview with composer Denny Zeitlin, audio commentary with author/film historian Steve Haberman, audio commentary by director Philip Kaufman, Revisitors from Outer Space, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Pod, including interviews with director Philip Kaufman, screenwriter W.D. Richter, director of photography Michael Chapman, and actors Donald Sutherland and Veronica Cartwright. We've also got Practical Magic, the special effects pod, The Man Behind the Scream, the sound effects pod, which is an interview with Ben Burt and sound editor Bonnie Kaler, The Invasion Will Be Televised, the cinematography pod, theatrical trailers, TV and radio spots, photo gallery, and an episode of Science Fiction Theater entitled Time is Just a Place, based on Jack Finney's short story and directed by Jack Arnold. And this one is still scheduled to come out on August 2nd. And we've got another lineup of DVDs that are coming out, and this one is coming from Arrow. So, console your wallets, folks. Here we go. Coming out in both the U.S. and the U.K., The Hills Have Eyes. We're getting a brand new Blu-ray of that. What you'll find is a 4K restoration, brand new from the original film Elements, supervised by producer Peter Locke. You got the original mono audio, optional subtitles, 6 postcards, reversible fold-out poster featuring new and original artwork, limited edition booklet featuring new writing on the film by critic Brad Stevens and a consideration of the Hills franchise by Ewan Kant, illustrated with original archive stills. You've also got commentary with Wes Craven and Peter Locke. Looking back, Hills Have Eyes. This was the hour-long making-of documentary that some of you may know from Anchor Bay's 2-disc DVD that came out, I believe it was 2003. It's got the interviews with Craven, Locke, actors Michael Behrman, Dee Wallace, Janice Blythe, Robert Houston, Susan Lenoir, and director of photography Eric Sarian. Then we've got The Desert Sessions, brand new interview with composer Don Peake, an alternate ending in HD for the first time. Trailers and TV spots. Image Gallery has a BD DVD-ROM original screenplay, a reversible sleeve featuring new and featuring original and new artwork by Paul Shipper. And apparently there's more to be announced for this title. So,
wow.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people are going to be excited for this one. Slugs is coming to Blu-ray.
Yes.
In the U.S. This one has a brand new restoration from original film Elements, high definition Blu-ray presentation, original uncompressed PCM stereo audio, optional English subtitles, audio commentary by writer-filmmaker Chris Alexander, an interview with actor Emilio Linder. This one's called Here's Slugs in Your Eye. Next, they slime, they ooze, they kill. The Effects of Slugs, an interview with special effects artist Carlo De Marquis. Invasion USA, an interview with art director Gonzalo Gonzalo. The Lion's Den, an interview and locations tour with production manager Larry Ann Evans. The 1988 Goya Awards promo reel, original theatrical trailer, reversible sleeve featuring original and newly commissioned artwork by Wes Ben Scotter. Fully illustrated collector's booklet featuring new writing by writer Michael Gingold. Nice. And this is another one that I know a lot of folks are going to be looking forward to. This one is Dead End Drive-In. And what you're going to be getting with this one is a 2K restoration from the original Elements. It's going to be in high def, optional English subtitles, audio commentary by director Brian Trenchard-Smith. The Stuntman, Trenchard Smith's classic television documentary on Grant Page and other Australian stunt performers. Hospitals Don't Burn Down, Trenchard Smith's 1978 public information film told in pure Ausploitation fashion. And plus you also get a theatrical trailer. And for the first pressing only, you're going to get a fully illustrated collector's booklet containing writing on the films by Cullen Gallagher and Neil Mitchell. Now, the street dates, the UK street dates for Dead End Drive-In is going to be September 19th. So I'm assuming they're going to be coming out this the day after in the States, because that's been the trend. Slugs is coming out on September 26th, and The Hills Have Eyes will also be coming out on the 26th. So it'll probably be the 27th in the US. Now, for the UK only releases, they're going to get Raising Kane, which Screen Factory is going to be putting out here in the States. They're also releasing Joe Dante's Matinee and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which, by the way, Criterion is going to be putting out in September as well here in the United States. For the UK, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls comes out on September 5th, Matinee September 12th, Raising Kane also September 12th. And that's all I got, Sean. That's all the news this week.
All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll be talking to you next week for sure.
All right. See you guys next week.
His kid has the best laugh, though. It's like stock child laughter that you hear in a movie.
In a horror film is the problem.
Yeah.
It's like the fucking children in Blair Witch Project out by the tent.
That's what we should do. We should just be like, Sean, we need you to record your kid's voice. We don't know when we'll use it, but we may need child laughter.
We'll just have stockpile of fucking child laughter. Noah growing up. Fucking Noah's movie reviews.
Oh, that was so good. I don't know why that's not a segment. Because it's easy. It's just one segment, like 1 second. No, what'd you think of this?
I didn't like it. Not good. No, we have to have a little segment where you watch movies Noah and then he does a review. It's like that one video guy that does movie reviews, but then he has his mom review him. This is not a joke. It's a real thing.
No, I've seen those. They're funny.
That's hilarious.
Right. But we did also discuss that Noah has the most stock footage child laughter sound to his laugh.
Dude, you can record it and then sell it.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, all right, here we go.
Let's start this shit.
Are you yawning?
Are you yawning? Yeah, because you're fucking boring me with your bullshit.
All right, here we go. So today, since Conjuring 2 just recently came out, we actually, all three of us, got to see it within the same week. So Brad brought this up that we should talk about Conjuring 2 and maybe even talk about James Wan's career, because it's been pretty cool career, like starting with, he got popular with Saw, and then he kind of went from there. And he's the first time I ever, knew who he was from Saw. And then I kind of wrote him off after that. I didn't really pay attention, until the past few years with, even with, Dead Silence and Death Sentence but then with Insidious and then The Conjuring and all of a sudden he's getting these big studio projects like Furious, 7 and then now Aquaman. What?
Pass on that.
His career's, ramping up. It's pretty cool to see that happen to a director like this. So Brad, why did you want to talk about James Wan so bad? What was the
Because he's going to be one of these horror icons like Carpenter in probably like 20 years.
Yeah.
Because he steps in and makes a fucking movie that carries a franchise. He has brutality with his films, such as Death Sentence, and just he knows how to build the sense of dread like Carpenter does. And I'm not basing he's John Carpenter. No, but he has that trajectory of kind of that Wes Craven Carpenter thing. Like I truly believe that he's going to be one of those people, depending on what genre movies he stays in with as well. Carpenter always branched out, so did Craven, and even so did Romero. But, it's a different caliber. But, starting off with Saw, for me, I watched Saw. I fucking loved the very first Saw film. I think it is really effective. I think it's really good. With me, big surprise, I have never actually watched the entire series of Saw because I can't make it past the one with Donnie Wahlberg, whatever one that one is. I really can't. Really? I've watched the first and the second one, and I think I've watched the third one. Did the third one have Donnie Wahlberg?
I think so. I think that was the third one, yeah.
Okay, I can't make it past that after the kid's in the safe or something.
Oh, that's the second one.
Oh, shit. I've never seen the third one.
What?
So anyways, the second the second one's really bad. And I really, I guess I've tried watching the third one. Is the third one with the tape and the person?
There's tapes in, the tape in his body?
Yeah, they're doing
I can't remember. They all run together for me.
They're doing an autopsy or something.
That one is four. 4. No, I lied. Yeah, four. Four. That one's four.
See, this is what I'm talking about. We can't even decipher which ones they are. There's like eight of them.
When it gets to my round, yeah.
Keep going. So anyways, it's, you know, taking the first film alone and throwing the franchise away, the first film alone, I think it holds, it shows actually Cary Elwes, which I've always thought, and I said this on the Crush episode, Cary Elwes is fucking underrated as fuck. He's such a good actor when he does serious and serious films and dramas. I mean, he gets typecasted as kind of the goofy smile guy and like fucking Robin Hood Men in Tights. But I think he truly is, a great actor. And then, you know, Lee Whannell started as an actor, and then he's in this as well, which does a great job, which he also co-wrote with James Wan with the script. But I think Saul holds like such this special place of kind of taking horror and kind of it almost created. It also pushed kind of that torture thing a little bit, which it was never a good thing, but it almost sparked like this whole wave of horror films after its release, because there's a lot of copycats that try to do that. But it's not too many people can make a movie. It's not, I don't think it's his debut. I don't think it's his first feature. I think James Wan did something else before that. I just don't think I've ever seen it. But I think it was a horror film. But to create a movie like that in that universe and carry a franchise and kind of kickstart this wave of horror films, I think that's pretty substantial as your first film. Kind of basically what Carpenter did with Halloween. Mm-hmm. Created a franchise, did a wave of slashers. You know, even though it's not considered the very first slasher, you know, because we have
Peeping. But it's the one that skyrocketed it.
Right, you know, you have Peeping Tom before that, and you have Black Christmas. But, I mean, definitely Halloween was so popular that spawned a massive amount of, copycats and, you know, inspired by Halloween movies. But I think the same, James Wan did the same thing with Saw, and I think truly remarkable. And I think the film alone is like, you mentioned Saw, and I know a lot of people roll their eyes, and yeah, I do too. But as the first movie, I think is completely solid. It's creepy, it's gory, it's brutal. It has a fucking cool ass twist that you don't expect. Like, it's really well written. It has fucking Danny Glover in it. It has Dina Meyer. Like, it's got this really cool fucking cast. You know, it's got all these like cool little things, like, you know, trying to, you know, guy's not really killing anybody. These people are dying because of these contraptions that he made. And, you know, I just think it's a really cool concept. And I think he did a really great job. I really do. Because I remember seeing Saw and like, man, that's really fucking good. Now, of course, like I said, the sequels, which I'll let BJ, because I know she wrote an article about watching all the Saw movies in one sitting. Was it one
I
sitting?
I sure did. One sitting.
Oh my God.
All 11 hours. 11 hours straight.
Is that why you can't tell them apart?
Kind of. Well, because it's a combination of that, and then also because they're not in order as far as like the timelines are all kind of over the place. So in my brain, I think about the story in, you know, chronologically, but it's not chronologically with the films. Like, some of them take place before others, and that's what gets confusing, especially if you watch it all in one sitting.
Oh my gosh. That would mess
me
up.
I got paid some pretty decent dollars to do it, so it was worth it.
My favorite one, I think, is of the sequels was one with the healthcare type stuff. Was
yep, that's my favorite. Number six.
Six, yeah.
Yep, that one's my favorite.
I always heard six was good.
Yeah, six is a lot of fun, and I think it kind of, it's definitely still, it still feeds into the kind of the gore and the torture porn type thing, but it also brings back the whole idea of morality, mm-hmm. and, you know, having to pay for your life choices. Closest, I think, to the first movie, which is why I like that one so much. And like this is where it's going to get a little funky, and I may lose a couple people. But I'm 26 years old. James Wan is my Wes Craven. He is my John Carpenter. Obviously, I was fortunate enough to have parents that let me watch Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, all of that shit when I was way too young to be watching it. So they are always going to be, you know, the tops for me. But the Saw was the first movie I ever snuck into a theater to see. Like, I was, you know, 14 or 15 whenever it came out, snuck into the theater to see it. So James Wan started, you know, that franchise for me, and I'm a total apologist for it, the same way that a lot of people are apologists for the really shitty Friday the 13th films or the really shitty Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, installments or what have you. And because it has kind of that level of nostalgia, or I watched this when I was in high school and I took this girl on a date and this is what we did and we saw it. And, you know, you think of that when you see those films. And that's how I am with the Saw sequels, because that was my Halloween for 7 years. Like, if, you know, Halloween, you saw film, and that was what I did in my adolescence. And to be like a young horror kid that always knew I had this to look forward to was kind of a big deal. And I mean, I'm glad that with things like Insidious and The Conjuring, it is proving that James Wan isn't kind of this one-hit wonder. He's not some guy who made a really good movie that spawned a franchise and then did nothing else. He's shown that he is remarkably gifted at what he does. Because if you look at, I mean, a little bit, you can see the parallels between the Insidious films and The Conjuring. Mm-hmm. But if you look at Insidious, the first Conjuring, and Saw, and you line them up, they're very, very different films in the way that they approach how they're going to scare you. Saw has kind of that, like, new metal, like, twitchy cam thing going on, where, like, they're, like the quick motion. I always think of
it's
when
like
Amanda's head.
Yeah.
Like, when her head's in the reverse bear trap and everything's, like, reverse and going fast at the same time, and it, like, fucks with your adrenaline. And then you go to something like Insidious, which I think is a lot more old school in the sense that it's very score driven and it's very deliberately paced and has a good combination of slow build up and then like big punches. And then The Conjuring, I think those films have those slow build ups and like the, you know, the focus is pushing you to look right, but there's something in the left. And that's what's so scary, is that you're catching like bits and pieces of it. And just his iconography in all of his films are so fucking strong. I mean, sure, we're not getting like a Michael Myers type thing, but like Billy the Puppet. Everybody knows Billy the Puppet. Everybody knows the fucking lipstick face demon. Everybody knows like the creepy lady, old lady, the Black Bride or whatever she's called.
Yeah.
And now we have this goddamn nun from The Conjuring 2. I mean, he's so smart at the way that he, you know, characterizes these monsters and these scenarios. And that is, you know, the true sign of somebody who knows what they're doing. Are there horror films that have come out, you know, around James Wan that have like affected me more or scared me more? Yeah, absolutely. But is it something that I can, you know, point to on a screen and somebody knows exactly what it is, even if they've never seen it? You know, that's the true thing. Because there are people that can take one look at that lipstick face demon and go, Insidious, not watching it. Or, Saw, not watching it. And they've never even seen it. You can't do that with It Follows. You can't do that with Starry Eyes.
Yeah.
Those are films that I love that arguably affected me way more. But as far as just that universal reach, like, Wan is a, like, he's a living master right now. And just, I hope he doesn't leave horror behind. I really hope he doesn't.
Yeah, no. It'll be interesting to see what happens once he's finished with Aquaman. If he even goes through with it, right? Because he's still in pre-production for Aquaman. He's kind of getting roped into
I'm not
that.
Not following at all.
That craziness. Well, I know that he's, you know, he's done the whole thing that all these directors always do, saying that, don't worry, your beloved character is in good hands, blah, blah, blah. You know, basically, he's trying to say, like, I'm not going to fuck up like Zack Snyder did.
It always worries me, though, whenever somebody talks about Aquaman, because all I can ever think of is the interviews that Adam Green has done where he was originally supposed to write the script for it years ago, and the note they gave him was less water. Or I think it was actually, can you do it without water?
Right.
So that makes me a little uneasy as to what the hell producers are saying, but that's neither here nor there.
Who knows?
Anyway, Sean, your feelings on Juan.
Juan, I feel like I was a little bit late to the party, I think, with discovering Saw and his movies. I started really diving into Saw and his movies in, I think, 2007. I think that was the year that Dead Silence and Death Sentence came out. And I remember just seeing Dead Silence on like the video shelves and just kind of being like, oh, that's the guy that did Saw. Oh, he's doing a creepy puppet movie like Child's Play. And that's all I thought, because when I first saw, I liked it okay. And then, I watched all the sequels that were, I don't know the order. I think I saw up to 4 maybe in 2007. So I saw like 1 through 4 and saw it was okay. I didn't really like the new metalish, you know, filming of it and everything, but I liked the first Saw the best. And then I started looking and then watching like the special features on the first Saw DVD and seeing him in interviews. And I really liked him like as a person, like him talking about the making of the films and how what he likes and things like that. So I kind of like connected him with him that way as like a person. Not just some director of a horror movie. Like I saw kind of who he was, you know, behind everything. So I sought out Dead Silence and I rented that and I really loved Dead Silence. I thought it was just going to be some stupid, you know, haunted doll movie or killer doll movie or something, but it was like something more than that. You can tell that he, had more going on. I think as an artist, like he wanted to create these films not just as a gimmick, but actually do something, you know, with the cinematography and the story. And then I checked out Death Sentence with Kevin Bacon, and that movie, it was a different genre, and I was like, impressed that he was going to take a different genre. And so that's kind of was my introduction to James Wan. And then since Insidious came out, as he's just been killing it with these films. He's getting better and better with these haunted films. Like, I'd like to see him do something more than just like haunted houses and paranormal stuff. Unfortunately, the only thing that we've seen him do is like Furious 7, you know, the only thing outside the horror toolbox. So, like he's getting better and better, and Conjuring 2 was just like so well done on a whole other level, I think, than his previous films, like what he's doing with the camera and his use of effects and his use of the practical effects, you know, with like the Crooked Man and things like that. Like I feel like I'm just now excited for a James Wan film. Whereas before I've been like, oh, it's just a James Wan film. Oh, he's going to do another haunted something. But I feel like he's continuing to take everything he's learned, even in like Furious 7 with a big budget. He's taking that sensibility into like The Conjuring 2, and he really, I think, hit a home run with it, you know. So I'd like to see him do more horror. I'd like to see him go outside the poltergeists, you know.
Yeah,
I'd like to see him do a straight up monster flick.
Oh, yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah, no,
he has the eye for it.
But I mean, we have Saw, which is, you know, and it's a horror film in itself. But then he did Death Sentence, which was an exploitation type vigilante film, you know, bloody fucking revenge. And if I know that's probably one of his less seen movies, but dude, it's definitely one of his best films. And then, you know, he came back kind of with, because I consider Dead Silence one of his very first, like, real horror films. Mm-hmm. I mean, Saw is horror in its own way, but it's almost like situation. Like, the situation is horrifying. It's not really a horror film until, like, you know, the pig mask thing pops up. They're snapping the camera in the dark. you know, garage and shit like that. And, you know, Billy popping out the, you know, which also he, like, you know, I forgot to say, but BJ mentioned it. So this guy fucking created two horror icons in one movie. Not right. Just one. He didn't create Michael Myers and move on. No, he created Jigsaw and Billy the Puppet.
Yep.
Insane. You know, and then he came with Dead Silence, which I really fucking loved. The opening to that movie with them in the apartment and the doll pop, like, I find that super creepy. It has Dead Silence takes, you know, the 70s and 80s, like, dreary and, you know, just kind of daunting horror film look and just makes a spin on it and puts it in this, like, weird, like, horror fantasy childlike you know world. I love it. Everything he did with Dead Silence, it's creepy. It reminds me of being a kid watching a movie from the 80s. You know, even though Donnie Wahlberg is in it, he does
what do you have against Donnie Wahlberg? Poor Donnie Wahlberg.
He's awful.
He's pretty good in, he was in Band of Brothers, wasn't he? He's pretty good in that.
I don't know. But anyways, I think everything, and I think he likes dolls and puppets, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But he really knows, because there's a fear with puppets and dolls if it's presented correctly. I mean, but Billy is creepy. The Night of Living Dummy from Dead Silence is creepy.
He's very creepy.
I mean, dolls are creepy to begin with.
Goosebumps? Night of Living Dummy?
Well, dude, that's what this doll looks like in Dead Silence.
Looks totally like the night.
He looks just like it.
And, you know, and of course, Annabelle from The Conjuring. Just, he really knows how to, I mean, I guess, I don't know if it's that hard to create a creepy doll, but something that, like, you know, just goes into your mind and just, like, won't leave, I think that's an achievement.
My daughter is obsessed with Annabelle, and she's never seen it. She just sees the puppet, and she's like, I remember when that movie, when Annabelle came out, my daughter and all of her friends wanted to go see it. And, you know, there's a couple, it's just the image of that doll, you know, with, I think, that age, especially like a 10-year-old or 9-year-old girl, I guess 9-year-olds in general, like, every time she sees the Blu-ray, she wants to watch it. It's crazy.
But yeah. I've met the doll.
Yeah?
It's real unsettling. Like, even after seeing Annabelle, the very lackluster film, on its own, that doll's still really unsettling to be around.
Totally. Did you get, there's a YouTube video of a bunch of supposed haunted dolls. Did you guys see that?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was posted over at Blumhouse. Was it Blumhouse that posted that?
From
Rob. Yeah, I watched that today during work. It's pretty terrifying stuff.
So, all right, dolls. Dolls are fucking creepy. And then, you know, he takes a little break and then comes back with his, like, a South by Southwest, and it was kind of mixed with the reception guy. And, you know, he made a PG-13 horror film that doesn't feel like a PG-13 horror film. Created a movie that was loved by many. I mean, it's half and half, it seemed. And I was always pro Insidious no matter what, and I argued this movie to the death, basically. Because I was always like, Insidious is definitely one of the better horror films of that year. And I think it's very, very clever. You know, because I think, I know, Lee Whannell is a fantastic writer. He really knows how to not make just an ordinary horror film. Because you look at Insidious now, because Insidious 2 and 3 come out, so we get more of kind of the universe that is built and where the movies were going. But just take the very first Insidious film, and you have the story of the child that is in the film, and, you know, the whole thing is, You know, what is it, Dalton? Dalton isn't, it's not your house haunted, it's your son. Ooh, that's creepy. But you have to think of it in such a way, and it's never really blatantly said in the movies until we kind of get into, you know, later in two. But look how clever Insidious is on its own, and it doesn't get the credit, is that in the film, the ghosts are never, ever there for Dalton. They're there for our, you know, Josh Lambert, Patrick Wilson's character. Because he has these memories suppressed. All they're doing is they're kidnapping basically the son and trying to get him to remember the horrifying events that happened so they can actually get to him. And I think that's fucking clever as shit. It's never really said in the movie. Like, it's never said until, like, in the sequel, they kind of hint more at that and really kind of solidify that that's, you know, where they're going. But it's never said, hey, we're ghosts, we're actually here for him. No, I thought that was super clever.
Well, that's why it's so smart, because so many horror films today, I think, are so worried about everyone in the audience getting it, that everything is kind of presented on a silver platter, like there's no, like, ambiguity at all. Whereas even to the last frame of the first Insidious, it's like, oh, wait, well, why is the lady in his photos? Why? I don't understand. Like, and that's just, why don't more people do that? I mean, it just shows why he's great. But any other director or production company or whatever would be like, you need to explain this before the credits roll. And have her, like, look at the camera and be like, I'm here for you, or some dumb shit.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, the only thing that I do agree with people on is that Insidious does lose a little bit of steam once they go into, you know,
the further?
Darth Maul's, you know, lair.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I do agree. But, you know, hey, it's either near there. I can't take one scene out of a movie and say that it's bad. I mean, because sometimes one scene can totally change a movie for you. Or even an ending of a film can make the whole film great, because then you're like, oh, shit, like, that's cool. And then you think back and you're like, oh, shit, it led up to that. That's awesome. But that's how I felt with Insidious. Like, once it ended, it gives you that, you know, also it doesn't have an ending, a satisfying conclusion. It ends like the fucking Ring does, where it's like, oh shit, what the fuck is, oh my God, like, how am I going to go to sleep tonight? Like, nothing's okay right now. Like, I have no idea what's going on. Josh is possessed. He fucking kills somebody. Who knows what's going to happen to the family? The ghost fucking won. Like, hey, the boy didn't go through an exorcism. That's different, because that's what we're all expecting to happen. You know, and I don't know. I think Insidious is carried in such a way. And I know people are listening, they're like, oh, Brad, you're full of shit. And that's fine. But I you know, Insidious to me, and Insidious 1, 2, and 3, I think is a great trilogy. And I think Insidious 2 is way better than Insidious. And
I really liked Insidious 2. I loved Insidious 2.
Yeah, and so I think Insidious 2 is a lot stronger, because it also kind of dives more into, now we have Origins of the Ghost, which I think is cool. Also, you have this, you know, parallel story of Josh Lambert being possessed and going through those motions. I think the whole film those two films are very clever. I do like the third one, but it obviously goes in a different direction, leaving the Lambert family.
I don't hate the third one. I do like, though, that it's a film that's focusing on, you know, Lynn Shay's character, because how often do you get a horror film that is focusing on protagonist that isn't a 25-year-old girl?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, we have, you know, an elderly lady basically running the show and kicking ass, which is not really seen or heard of. And it's about time that she actually gets a lead role.
They lure you in with that teenage girl, but really it's like, God, finally, yeah.
Yeah. But I truly think Insidious 2 is another great film. And then, you know, he's doing The Conjuring in between these films. So he has Insidious, Insidious 2, and The Conjuring 2, all within a span of, what, like 5-6 years of one another? Mm-hmm. Insidious and The Conjuring, you couldn't even tell. Like, if you sat me down, I wouldn't be able to tell you that those are the same director. You have both films, or both, you know, 1 and 2 of Insidious. You have 1 and 2 of The Conjuring, of course. But Insidious is a lot more like in your face, jump scares, very much like the 80s, 90s. It takes that toll. The cinematography is really great. He kind of withholds that, you know, old school ghost story look. And then we have The Conjuring. What is happening right now?
Somebody breathing?
No.
No.
It's raining outside. Maybe that's it.
That was really creepy because we are talking about ghost stories and shit. Oh my god, I like heard it again.
I don't. I'm not moving. I'm just laying on
you're
laying
sad excuse
for a futon. No, like I'm holding the phone.
Hmm.
Is Laura Barnes on this call? Like only 10 people probably got that joke. So, and then we have The Conjuring, which is very much like the 70s style of, you know, haunted house and ghost stories and hauntings and exorcism. And just right off the bat, you know, going back to Halloween with what Michael Myers is in the film. We have, of course, the death of his sister in the beginning, but Michael Myers doesn't kill anybody for about 45 minutes. But he doesn't need to. The movie doesn't need that. It builds that sense of dread. It makes you scared of what is to come. And with the opening in The Conjuring, we have the story of Annabelle, a side story that's not relation to the movie, setting up what is to come in this film. No one dies in the beginning of The Conjuring. We just have a story of Annabelle. In fact, aside from the ghost, no one fucking dies in The Conjuring. Like, we have zero deaths in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
No, just a lot of scary shit.
And just a lot. And we build and we're building and building and building. We have the title card come up with black background and yellow text with this fucking haunting sound. And then we have the family. You know, we go through the window. We arrive with the family coming down. We walk through the door. The kids are excited. And then what happens? The dog sits there and whimpers and doesn't want to come inside. And already we're like, fuck. The dog already knows. And here we go. And ever, like, minute after minute, it builds more sense of dread. And we are terrified with this family because now we're with a bunch of little girls. We have a fucking scene in The Conjuring where nothing is actually shown in a black corner and it terrifies us.
God, nothing it is so scary.
Nothing is shown in that fucking corner. There's no shadow. There's no movement. There's absolutely nothing. It is a camera at a dark corner with one of the best performances of fucking being scared I've ever seen in my life. And it absolutely is fucking terrifying. That's what James Wan can do that not a whole – I just heard something really loud in my ear, like a crackling. Laura Barnes is totally on this call, by the way. No, seriously, what is that noise?
I don't know.
I think it's you breathing into the phone, BJ.
No, I'm like a – like. You'd be able to tell if I was breathing into the phone. Like, I'm not breathing into the phone.
Okay.
Dang, Sean, you just got told.
I think, I think what it is that it's, like, it's raining really hard, so it has one of those, like constant sounds going on. I think it might be that.
Gotcha.
Because when you talk, you're crystal clear. But, like, when you're not talking, you can hear, like, that noise.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
It sounds like
a
demon breathing into this.
So constantly just do like a really high-pitched, like, squeaky hum so that way your microphone picks that up instead of the rain.
Okay.
But, I mean, and then of course we have The Conjuring 2, which is just relentless on scaring you and really wants to visually just take us in the original Conjuring. We have a lot of noises, creaking, a lot of music, the music starts and builds up. We have shadows. We have doors slamming. Conjuring 2 is just like, you know what? Fuck it. We're just going to show you every... We have three goddamn villains in this movie, and we're going to scare you with each fucking one. And it's like, what the fuck? Like, I could barely deal with fucking Sheba, the first one. Now I got to deal with three of these motherfuckers?
I think The Conjuring 2 sort of marries Insidious with The Conjuring 1.
Yeah.
In sort of their styles. It's definitely got that in-your-face... Just God, that fucking nun, dude. Oh God. But it has kind of like that in your face, like here's the fucking nun, similar to like the lipstick face demon, but still has the sensibility of the first Conjuring film. So it's a really smartly crafted film because it's real fucking scary.
Yeah, and he builds that, but also another thing that really works for The Conjuring, and it's not so much in Insidious, it's definitely more driven in The Conjuring 1 and 2, is that the story of the family, we have these kids, we feel for each one of those, that relationship, we feel like we're part of that family. The relationship and the dynamic and the chemistry between, Vera and
Patrick Wilson.
Yeah, Patrick Wilson's character, you know, as Ed and Lorraine Warren, it's beautiful. Like it's really great. Like I'm not a believer in, you know, any religion or, you know, anything like that. But dude, the line where she says God brought us together for a reason and this is it. Like when they're in the basement and like shit's going down and she says that, I'm like, oh fucking shit just got real. You know, and it's just and that carries over with the second one. I mean, it's its own movie. There's no relation to The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2 other than maybe when he gets into, they tell a story and there's that flashback of her having the vision of him. And then we have maybe the picture of the house and the tree that, you know, he drew that was in the living room or the art room when you actually see the nun. But it feels like it's its own movie at the same time.
Oh,
like
yeah.
And it totally takes the story of Ed and Lorraine and their relationship and the dynamic between them and solely focuses on them for a good portion, even though we're dealing with this, you know, Enfield poltergeist over in the UK. Mm-hmm. We're getting more and more with them. And just that relationship and kind of that story of their building blocks and, you know, coming to kind of this end of them wanting to stop because of the things that they've been through, I think is beautifully done for such a terrifying horror film that we can scare us, but we can also, you know, make us, you know, have this heartfelt, like when he sings, the Elvis Presley song,
mm-hmm.
like that's such a beautiful moment. It reminded me of John Hanks and Martha Macy, Mae Marlene. It's just like he kind of just pulls you in with his lyrics, and you know, it's obviously Patrick Wilson really singing. I read, which was even better. But it's such a sweet little moment in the film, and does so much for Ed and Lorraine's character. And then it just wants to fucking scare you again. And I thought that was pretty clever because I don't know too many horror films that can make you feel for two people like that. And
yeah.
Also, because we don't really care about, like, honestly, I don't know if we care so much about the family. Like, the family's there, they're being haunted.
Yeah, I really don't.
It's not like the family in the first film. Like, we totally want to be with that family. We want to hang out with those kids. It's a beautiful moment. Like the story of the beach and the story behind that picture is beautiful, and everything about that is a really good story, and that there's great chemistry with the kids and everything. But with this family, they're just kind of there to kind of put this poltergeist in your face, and really it's Ed and Lorraine's movie, just kind of like how Lynn Shay stole the the movie in part three. They totally take the movie, and it's truly about them. and their relationship, but they're dealing with these fucking poltergeists on the side. And I thought that was truly remarkable too, because even though James Wan has done almost back-to-back four haunted house movies, each one is different in its own way. And we're possessed, exorcism. No, it takes a different route each time. There's no exorcism in Insidious. It has a horrifying conclusion. In the second Insidious, we open it up for, oh shit, shit's going to go down. We're cool now, but something's going to be stirring fairly soon. We have The Conjuring, which kind of ends on itself, but also opens that door to that universe of like, all right, this is done. Hey, but guess what? The priest wants us to go check up, you know, up in fucking, you know, Amityville.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, shit. And then it opens on Amityville, which I thought was fucking brilliant, by the way. I knew that was coming, but goddamn, that was awesome. You know, and then we open on Amityville and kind of have that same opening that we do with, you know, Annabelle. We have that story that's being told, and then we're introduced to, you know, an entity that shows up throughout the film that is obviously steals the show of everything else and is definitely one of the more terrifying villains I've seen in quite some time, especially with the Crooked Man, which obviously is a villain in its own sense. You know, for those who haven't seen the movie, we're not going to spoil anything for you. But, I mean, our true villain is the nun in this. Which, did you know, I was reading that James Wan thought of that 3 months before the movie was supposed to be released, and they went ahead and they reshot all that shit?
I did hear that.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
And it's Joseph Bashar as the nun, isn't he? Who does all the music for it, and then he's also the lipstick-faced demon.
No, the nun is a real lady.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a. I forget her name, but yeah, I was looking it up.
No, Bashara
is
a
nun.
Yes, Bashara is the one from The Conjuring 1 and the lipstick face demon. That's what it is.
Oh, okay.
So then he scores all of his films too, which I also am like. That's the other thing that a lot of people aren't paying attention to as well is that he uses real people in creature suits, which. It shouldn't be a big deal, but is a big deal.
Yeah, especially where these ghost stories are heading is that we're so with the floating apparitions and, you know.
Right. We're so used to getting these like CGI, like glowing bullshit. And instead he's like, no, we're going to keep it old school. We're going to do makeup. Sure. Some things are enhanced with CGI.
Right.
But for the most part, they're people in suits.
And that's the one thing is I'm watching, you know, The Conjuring 2, and when the Crooked Man shows up, I'm like, man, fucking bravo to James Wan using stop motion. And then it's like, you know what? Hey, it's not stop motion. It's actually a dude in a suit. And I'm like, no, really? That's insane. It really is. Like, that is truly remarkable. I mean, obviously, that guy's been in, you know, numerous horror films.
Yeah, he's in Wreck.
And you know, obviously he has that body to where he can, you know, do crazy shit. But to move like that, to move so robotic, and to move in such a way that just gives you chills even without a suit. Because there was that, you know, because he's played Mama and Mama, and there's a lot of, you know, CGI in Mama. But there's that footage that they released, I think it was on the Blu-ray, of him in the suit moving, and
it's terrifying.
That's a lot creepier than the I don't have any idea, but it's like James Wan saw that and he's like, you know what, we're gonna fucking use that and we're gonna get you in a suit, and that's gonna be a lot creepier than any CG that we could possibly do. And I think the only probably enhanced was when the dog kind of manipulates into the Crooked Man. I think that's
That has to be.
Yeah, that has to be. But other than that, man, I couldn't believe what I was seeing and also feeling at that time. Like, I was expecting to enjoy The Conjuring, but I wasn't expecting to watch a horror film that was so remarkable that also touched on, you know, films like Turn of the Screw, Legend of Hell House. There's an obvious, really badass shot referencing The Shining, which is fucking fantastic.
Oh, it's so, so unsettling.
And, like, it's not even that he borrows, it's just that you can watch a movie and show, because, I mean, Tarantino does one thing, he directly takes characters, he takes sequences, he takes dialogue from his favorite films and kind of turns it into his own, which I appreciate, because he's giving love to these films that are obviously forgotten about and lost, and, you know, definitely people can discover from his films. But you watch something from James Wan, like The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2, we have, like, I just feel like I'm so familiar with that type of work that it makes me feel like I'm watching a movie from that era. It makes me feel like I just pulled, like, because what I would do is I would buy, you know, I told this story multiple times, so I won't go into too much detail. My mom would buy me box lots of VHS tapes when I was little. And so the summer I would have, like, you know, 100, 200 tapes to watch. Like, she would just buy these box lots off of eBay. And it would remind me of, like, picking up something like Legend of Hal House, something like that, and popping into the VCR, watching it late at night, and, you know, really enjoying the cinematography, enjoying the film itself, maybe not enjoying the film, but enjoying the look of the film. It watching his movies makes me feel like that again, because it feels like I'm something that's so familiar. Because even watching the first Amityville film, I think the first Amityville film is entirely so terrifying. It's, you know, people are like, nothing happens. Well, that movie has a great build up, a sense of dread. It has great leads, great chemistry with the family, especially with Josh Brolin. You know, is it Josh? James Brolin. Josh is the kid, right? Josh is the kid. Josh is the son.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. James Brolin. That just emulates and pours so much into Juan's work and his love for cinema and cinematography in those films that, you know, if you slapped the corny cliche grain on these films, I would watch it and think it was a film from that era. Like, that's how cool, and, like, I feel cool when I watch his movies. And you can't really say that about too many filmmakers watching movies. You're like, that movie's cool. But when I feel like I belong and this movie belongs in my life, that's a pretty cool feeling. And not too many filmmakers can make me feel like that. And James Wan is obviously one of them. So.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. I'm on the same page. I think that he's, you know, a true tour de force in all that he's doing. And I've been very interested to see how the separation of him and Lee Whannell has been. As far as, like, storylines go, it seems like, you know, when James went off and did Furious 7, it gave Lee time to do things like Cooties and The Mule. And it's just really interesting to me to see.
Fantastic.
Oh, they're great. They're absolutely great.
The Mule is fucking so fucking good.
Yeah. No, I fucking really, really, really loved it. But I think that those are two of the best, you know, voices right now in the genre. And they both, you know, kind of came up together. And I'm hoping that at some point they reconnect. But,
oh, yeah, 100%.
I think that, you know, the two of them combined, they're unstoppable. But the fact that we have somebody who has three, you know, bona fide franchises to their name, and he's really only been out since, you know, 2004, really. Obviously, he's been doing stuff before then, but that's when he, you know, skyrocketed to fame. But
in fucking 10 years, creating that much, like, that much buildup and just that much fucking coolness is kind of unheard of for any filmmaker.
Yeah, it's...
Unless you're Brian De Palma.
But even De Palma has his low points.
Yeah.
Black
That's
Dahlia.
True. Oof. Yeah. Woof.
But, I mean, and then you have, I mean, because we're totally forgetting about Furious 7, which now he's taking over a franchise. Well, I mean, he abandoned Part 8, but to do The Conjuring 2, thankfully. But he takes on the Furious Seven, which I know a lot of people like Furious Seven, and I'm a huge fan of kind of the Fast and Furious franchise. I think they're fun movies. I love the chemistry. I love the family aspect of it. I love how goofy action they are, but I was really looking forward to Furious 7. I know that Juan had some hiccups, obviously, because some awful things happened during the production of that film, which you can't fault him for that. But, you know, the one thing I can see, I wasn't a fan of Furious 7, but it shows me that Juan can do some fucking action.
Like, oh, absolutely.
He has it in Death Sentence, but it's more of like a DIY, like exploitation look of the film. Like, oh, that's cool, but Bill Lustig did that, and a lot of other people have made films like that. So, like, you're doing great, your movie looks good, but nothing too extreme. But I think with Furious 7, kind of the crazy action bits and sequences that Juan did, it makes me, I know now that James Wan can pretty much handle anything. I honestly, you said a monster movie, I kind of want to see this dude kind of do a drama. Like a straight up, like, family drama.
Well, if he did a family drama, I mean, all you would have to do is look at how he created the relationship between Ed, Lorraine, Warren, or the relationship between, the father, the father and daughter in Insidious 3, because he didn't write that one. But like the,
just a family in The Conjuring. We have the first one. But I really want to see him do something.
Well, the other thing too to even address, which is also kind of seems like a moot point, but is very important, is he also can work very well with children. And when you think about Carpenter or Craven or any of them, yeah, they'd have, you know, little Tommy down the street, but they're like kind of bit parts. He is making films that are centered almost entirely around children, and that's hard. And their performances, yeah. And like, that's hard enough to do when you're not making them walk around scary ass monsters. I interviewed, actress's name is Kyla Deaver. She played April in the first Conjuring, so she's the littlest of all of the kids. And she said in her interview, and mind you, she's like 6 years old, so, you know, it was a pretty fun interview. But she was talking about how he made it a point to safely introduce the children to like the lipstick face demon, to all of the creatures that were, or not the lipstick face demon. I'm so sorry. God, what is its name? The witch.
Oh, Bathsheba. Yeah. Sheba.
Thank you. Gosh, my brain. It's late. He introduced the children safely to Bathsheba by being like, here's the process, this is how it works, so that they would know to act scared, but not, you know, actually traumatize children, which is awesome to me. I think that it's really important that you're showing that you care that much about your cast and their well-being, especially with children. But yeah, that's an incredible accomplishment in and of itself, is that he manages to pull horrified, genuine horrified reactions out of children, which it's hard enough, I think, to get genuine horrified reactions out of adults acting in horror films. We've all seen plenty of them where we're like, oh god, just close your mouth, you look like an idiot, and he gets it right.
I agree on that, and a lot of his basically all his movies of these ghosts and goblins and stuff are based around children with the leads and supporting roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
he's the man. He's awesome.
Yep.
You know what? Really, for anybody that's doubting, rewatch The Conjuring and watch just the sequence. Just fast forward if you've already seen it. If you haven't seen it, watch the whole movie. But just fast forward to the sequence when they're actually going back to the house after she kidnaps the two kids, and Ed and Ron Livingston's character go up to the door and listen to the music that's happening at the same time. and the door is locked, and the cop goes to grab his shotgun from his trunk and cranks it and shoots open the door, and that tracking shot follows them into the house behind the cop after he blows open the door, and the fucking strings that are just blaring from that soundtrack, like, that right there just shows that James Wan is one of the best filmmakers to do that shot, to have that sound, like, it truly grabs you and just pull, like, that scene just grabs you and pulls you in, and you're like, holy fuck, like, there's just so much going on right now, and it's not jumbled, it's not too much, it's not busy, it's just very well thought out, processed, and contained. Because that's one thing with soundtracks in horror films. They can get a little too busy and kind of throw you off into another direction or kind of turn you off as well. But James Wan listens to that music and he knows what's going to work and what doesn't. You know, and whoever, all the people that he's used, I mean, what's the guy's name? Joseph what?
Bishara.
Yeah, the strings that guy does on these soundtracks.
They're ridiculous.
Is horrifying. And The Conjuring 2, not using strings, but kind of using this fucking, like, monk church type thing. Oh my God. Like, when that title card pops up, I'm fucking pissing on my seat just from the text. Nothing's even happened yet. And I'm like,
his music gives
goddamn.
Severe anxiety. I have, like, all of these different, like, horror score playlists on my computer when I'm writing, and I have a tendency to skip over the stuff that Joseph Bishara does because it makes me so scared and nervous.
I wouldn't be able to concentrate.
It really rushes my adrenaline, and I get, like, even thinking about it right now, I know I'm about to go to sleep, and I'm probably going to have nightmares tonight because I'm going to have those goddamn strings in my head, and I'm gonna pee myself. It's so scary and effective. He's so good.
Well, that's just the thing is that we, you know, because Willow fucking, she thinks The Conjuring's one of the best things ever. So she always wants to watch that when we have nothing else to watch. So of course, as soon as The Conjuring 2 comes out, that's what she wants to do opening night. Go, even though there's gonna be talkers, and she knows that. She's like, all right, let's do it. So, you know, the whole Amityville opening pops up. You know, she jumps a couple times. She squeezes my hand during The Nun. Everything's cool. The title card pops up with the music. My fucking hand is losing circulation because she's squeezing it so damn hard. And nothing's actually happening. And I'm like, good God, Willow. Like, what are you going to do when the fucking Nun pops up again or something else? But no, she squeezed the tightest when that music hit. And I'm like, God damn, dude. If, like, I love that is so effective on people. And I don't know if I said this, but I watched, I showed Willow the original Halloween. My daughter's 11 for any new people that are listening. She's 11. I let her watch Halloween for the first time just a couple, you know, a few weeks ago. And she jumped. She jumped twice and she gripped my hand really tight. She didn't grip my hands through the other films or wasn't scared. But the very first Halloween, she gripped my hand tight and she jumped. And I was like, God damn, that movie has the same fucking effect as it did in the 70s. And that's remarkable. And I really think that James Wan is on that same track with stuff like Death Sentence, with Saw, with The Conjuring 2, The Conjuring, all of that. I think he's on the exact same track to become that there's going to be, I mean, we're have a podcast on him, of course, but we're going to be talking retrospect in 20 years of this guy's career and what he did for that, you know, that group of kids that's growing up, that, you know, those moments that.
Yeah.
Kids...
I'm telling you right now that you talk to me 20 years from now and I will talk about the Saw sequels the same way that some people talk about, like, Halloween 6. Like, that's what's going to happen.
No one talks about Halloween 6.
Some people do. Even if it's, like, an ironic, I love this, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm going to be that person 20 years from now that's going to be like, you know what? I saw this movie when I was 19, and this is what it meant to me. Fuck you, kid. You don't know. Like, that's what's going to happen.
Like, I am that age. And then, like, my sister and my little cousin, who are a little younger than me, they're going to be the ones that are going to be talking about Insidious. And then, you know, Willow and, you know, her age group, they're going to be talking about The Conjuring. So that's three generations of people that are all going to be talking about those films 20 years from now when they're older. That's crazy. Because if you look at, you know, his, like, the people that came before him, like Wes Craven, for example, the people that were responding to Scream and the people that responded to Nightmare on Elm Street are not the same people. Like, obviously, the people who saw Nightmare on Elm Street at, like, their peak age, they revisited Scream, and it was like, oh, yeah, this is cool. This is, you know, a tongue-in-cheek kind of exploration of what we love, but they had Freddy first. Like, Scream was kind of a monster for, like, Ghostface was kind of a killer for a new generation. And James Wan has three franchises for three generations. That's nuts. And he's not even 40.
Yeah, I mean, look at Carpenter from 1978 to just 1988. Just 10 years, look what the guy accomplished.
Yeah,
he created some of the best horror films and some of the best action movies out there. And then again, that's exactly why I, you know, have that comparison with Carpenter and Wan, because they're both on the same track. They're both doing movies that they really want to do, and also creating this universe that is unique, that's giving us these characters that we'll forever hold on to. And I think that's fucking cool as shit.
Agreed.
Yep. All right, we got to wrap up.
Yep.
Yeah, it's late.
We could go one and one.
Jesus Christ, I'm just listening to you guys. And I'm like, I got nothing.
It's
1 a.m. our time, so you have no excuse, Mister.
I've been up since 4 a.m.
Mister Pacific time.
Hey, we're just really passionate about these things.
It's all good. It's all good. I'm having fun listening.
I just hope, like, I know that there's a lot of eye rolls with these movies, and especially Sidious, and people don't see eye to eye, or they don't get the feel or the vibe that Juan's putting out. But maybe give the movies another chance. What? Look at it that aspect, and I hope that you kind of see it that way. Maybe revisit Juan's whole filmography, and you'll kind of see the direction where he's going.
I think that's important, you know, kind of our comment about it, looking at these films 20 years from now. And that's why I think that he's just like Carpenter, and why he's just like, you know, Craven, because a lot of those movies didn't get great reviews when they first came out. People didn't understand them. And then you look at them 20 years down the line, and they're these just, they have obsessive fan bases, and they're reviled as these masterpieces. And that's what's happening. We're just, because of the internet, we're just now aware of it.
Yeah.
I feel like The Conjuring 2 is the most confident film, for sure. I wanted to watch the first Conjuring to kind of compare, but I mean, they feel like more, you know, like Insidious is a little bit more, like, I guess, rock and roll, and Conjuring would be a little more classical, like a little more, you know what I mean? There's like little, he separates each of his little franchises with different nuances, and The Conjuring series seems to be a bit more about, you know, some gorgeous cinematography, there's some really great, like we talked about in The Conjuring, but in Conjuring 2, there's the stuff going on in the house, and the camera kind of goes through the windows and follows certain kids. I think this is near the beginning of the movie, right, when all the kids are introducing each of the kids.
Yeah, he's got some great tracking shots with those fucking kids, man.
Yeah, and then there's the scene in the alley by the house, you know, as they're running towards kind of the basement area in the back, you know, characters run by there, the way the camera works there. Like, he's using the camera a different way in The Conjuring than he is in Insidious, or, you know, going back to Saw. Like, he has a lot of, you know, he can only get better, you know? And, So, you know, I'm a fan for sure.
But I just hope he doesn't leave horror.
Yeah.
Same. Or if he leaves, he has to come back.
Well, hopefully Aquaman just sucks, and then he'll come back to horror.
I definitely want to see him do other movies, but I definitely want to him to be Carpenter and just keep coming back off and on doing his own thing. But I really want him to make the movies he wants to make, but I do want to see him branch out.
Yeah.
But I definitely want to see his back in the horror setting and maybe not do another ghost movie because, I mean, we've fucking done four, but I really wouldn't mind another one with the Warrens. So as long as it continues maybe with the Warrens.
Well, the Warrens are great. Like that's the great through line, and that's what I liked about these Conjuring movies. They both felt like different films, you know, with the Warrens kind of playing a part in each one, but they weren't
they feel unrelated.
Like Insidious movies, it gets a bit exhausting because everything's connected. The Conjuring films, if it's just case files from the Warrens for the Conjuring films, I'm all in. It's great.
Yeah,
there's so much material in the mine.
I do think the Warrens are crooks, but I don't care. I'd rather hear his interpretations of
Well, they make for
case files.
They make for good stories.
Oh, yeah, and that's why they are who they are. But
nice.
Go James Wan. Go team. Yay Australia.
Oh yeah. All right, we'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on James Wan and The Conjuring 2, of course. So drop us a line. You can leave comments at the bottom of the page if you're on the screamcast.com on the show. Let us know what you thought. You can always send us an email, readme@thescreamcast.com. We're extending our Sean's Box of Porn drawing. I got like one person entered, so...
I can't enter.
Nobody wants to give embarrassing stories of being caught watching porn. That's all I'm asking. It's fun. Come on. Give us a story of a time you got caught watching porn. Unless all of you are super sneaky and have never gotten caught at all. I doubt it.
Next show, if we get at least 5 entries, I will tell my story on air about being caught watching porn.
Not to be a dick, but do people really think they're going to get it since we haven't shipped out the last shift of Tangerine
DVDs? Oh, shit. Yeah. I got to get you those addresses. And all of you who won that, I apologize. I suck.
They're coming.
Sean sucks.
I just got to email these goddamn addresses over to Brad, and he can send them
it's
out.
It's not even that hard.
It's not. I just...
You could just, you know, text me.
I forget. It's going to happen very soon. All right.
So, anyways, just enter into the drawing so you can win porno.
Yeah, for real. And I'm dead serious. If we get 5 more entries, I'll tell my story. It's a doozy.
Awesome.
Tell mine. I'm good.
Okay. Of course, check out our sponsors. Go to thescreamcast.com/sponsors. They're all right there. It's getting late and my brain's not working. So just go there and check them all out. Give some extra special love to Grindhouse Video. Buy your shit from them if you want to buy a movie.
Cheaper than Amazon.
Totally.
Hell yeah.
All right. And of course, thanks to oneofus.net for hosting our show. We will talk to all of you guys next week. Oh, if you want to donate, put a little change in the tip jar. We'd like to pay our writers on thescreamcast.com. So you can always go to screamcast.com/donate or go to screamcast.com. Just click the donate button. You can do it through PayPal. I haven't done Patreon yet. I'm still on the fence about Patreon. But if you want to be able to, you know, give a couple bucks a month or a one-time little donation or whatever to the show, that'd be awesome. All right. We'll talk to all of you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.
I got some diet orange soda and a Star Wars glass.
Nice.
I feel like a grown-up.
Are we including Fast 7 in this?
Yeah, I think we should. Well, okay. Because what I'm going to say, you'll see.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
Oh, my God. What does that mean?
Because I don't know what that means, is what it is.
Oh, my God.
You make me nervous.
Oh, my God.
That's amazing. Okay.